sixth chapter, they've got wicked again. Remember, they wiped out the Gadians simply by preaching the gospel to us. That may seem extravagant to us. But the Nephites go on getting wickeder and wickeder, and then see what happens. Why do they do this, you see? Because that didn't work at it. You have to fast and pray and things like that. The Lord had blessed them, and this is the reason. We like prosperity, so in the seventh verse, the Lord has blessed them so long with the riches of the world, they had not been stirred up to anger or wars, but began to set their hearts upon their riches to seek to get gain that might be one above another. Does that necessarily follow? Well, how do you measure gain? How do you measure wealth and power? By numbers, of course. The whole thing is done by numbers. You don't even have to have the money anymore. It's just the numbers. It used to be the numbers in the bank, the number of gold coins, and then it's the numbers on a... Now it's the number of blips. It's just something in the computer now, and yet you can have this vast wealth, as the Chicago trading has shown, without doing a thing. But it's all in terms of numbers, and of course, number is nothing but comparison. So you measure your greatness by number, and to be lifted up one above another, therefore, and to get it, they committed secret murders and rob and plunder that they might get game. I say back on prime time again. Now, and the game, Kishkumen and Gadianton, those two geniuses, got together again, and as many among the Nephites of the Gadianton band had to come back, there were many among the Nephites of the Gadianton band. This is the old gang, we mentioned as the assassins and so forth. The Lamanites found there was robbers among them, they were exceedingly sorrowful. Giant crime expose, but what are you going to do about it? Satan did stir up the hearts of the more part of the Nephites. They united with the bands. There was profit in it. There was business behind it. A giant brotherhood is what it turns out to be. But everybody's profiting in certain times. You know, we all invest. If they invest, they bought in, you see, is what they did. The more part of the Nephites, they did unite with those bands of robbers and did enter into their covenants, their oaths, that they would protect and preserve one another in whatsoever difficult circumstances they should be placed, that they should not suffer their murders and their plunderings and their stealings. Well, who are they going to plunder? If it's the whole nation, who are we plundering today as far as that goes? And their secret signs. Now here, at this point, let's ask this question. Isn't this getting to be... is the needle stuck or something like that? We're going to get the same routine over and over again. Does this lack of variety disturb you at all that we have here? Well, look at the records. Here I just wrote down, it's coming up here. You go through the historians, whether it's Herodotus, Thucydides, Polybius, Livy, Gellius, Suetonius, Appianus, Ammianus, Gregory of Tours, then you get into the Middle Ages, Gregory of Tours, say the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle or anything like that. We can save the trouble there by reading Gibbon. The whole, he'll give you all five volumes of it. But then the Middle Ages, you have Joinville, Lebel, all the chronicles there, the Peterborough Chronicle, Fulker, a marvelous secretary of the Duke of Hainaut, but he worked for everybody. Froissart even more so. He was a secretary of one king, worked for another king, and he spent a lot of time in Ireland, married two Irish wives and so forth. We don't realize that half the king of the court of Frederick II, the most fashionable thing was to speak Irish in those days. Amazing. And then the Eddas and Joinville and Froissart, I say, and Percy's relics. And we've got them all collected here in one massive collection made by the Germans in the late 19th century called the Monumenta Germanica. And we also have the Patrologia, thousands of volumes, Oriental, Greek, Latin. All these stories are all written out, and they're all the same as the Book of Mormon. There's nothing but downbeat. It's all dirty. It's all nasty. Well, what goes on here? Well, I guess Voltaire is right when he says, happy the people whose annals are blank. If you have nothing to say, if you have nothing to report, then your history is happy. But what kind of history is that? Who's going to read that? Got up this morning, brushed my teeth, we had a picnic and so forth. Well, 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 isn't that great? That's not going to be primetime TV. You've got to have the blood and murder, excuse me, and the intrigue and all that stuff. But in all this writing, there are a few flashes of light. They come in there. They're always connected with these people that called the great, nearly always. If some one individual moved them that way, like the prophets of old, who are called the great? It's not historians who bestow the title the great. It's by popular acclaim that it happens. It happens almost unconsciously. And so we have Alfred the Great, Alexander the Great, of course, and Karl the Great, with Charlemagne, Charlemagne the Great, and Peter the Great, and... they are the greats. They give us the happy moments. And what's so great about them? It's not their conquest. It's not their power, not their ego. Nobody ever wanted to call Napoleon Napoleon the Great. They all admitted that he was the greatest of conquerors. And Caesar, the same thing. They never called Caesar the Great or Napoleon the Great. But why do we have Alfred the Great? Because we think of Alfred and the plowboy. Alfred, who was determined that every plowboy in England would learn to read and write. Then you have Charlemagne, going to school as the emperor, sitting down on little seats with the little boys and girls in the school, girls too, in the school to learn how to read and write because he was illiterate. It wasn't beneath his dignity to do that. Well, they may have laughed at him in school, he would do that, and the same thing with Alfred. And you think of Peter the Great working as a common laborer, day laborer in the shipyards at Holland, so he'd learn how to make ships for his people. He wanted to have Russia to have a navy. And of course, here was the great Peter the great conqueror of the East, and he, just as a common laborer, and expected no more, this sort of person. These people we call the great. And Alexander, the one story we all know about Alexander is Alexander and Diogenes. Diogenes, you know, had a lamp and went around looking for an honest man, a social philosopher and other things, but he was in a barrel, which was in a public place there. He was permitted to do that, and everybody would be so busy, he would roll his barrel from one side to the other, one side to the other. What are you doing rolling your barrel? He says, well, everybody has to be busy in this town. I've got to do something. You have to look busy. See, this is the main point. You're not doing anything, but you roll your barrel on the picks. I don't know what they call it place. Well, anyway, Alexander the Great came to see him. The story. What can I do for you, said Alexander the Great. And he was sitting in the sun. The sun had just come up in the morning. He was getting warm. And Diogenes said, get out of the sun, please. That's what you can do for me. And Alexander, as he walked away, said to the people with him, if I were not Alexander, I would choose to be Diogenes. And the greatness of Alexander, they were not up to, they were not high and mighty. They realized that all others were equal to him. These would have been photo opportunities for our pseudo-greats today. No, they were very sincere about them, these people. And that's what made them the Greeks. Now, the Greeks don't have that title, the great, but they have the wise, you see, except Alexander. The greatest of Greeks was Solomon the Wise, or Solomon was Solomon the Wise. But we have the wisdom of Solomon, we have the wisdom of Solomon too. For example, his ode on the seven ages, seven ages of man, they're very sad in Solomon, as you know, in the wisdom of Solomon. The book of Ecclesiastes is bleak and sad as ever a writing can be. We've seen everything, it's all the same routine. Nothing's going to get any better on this earth, as far as that goes. Well, the history tells us no matter what happens, it never gets any better. But does it ever get any worse? So this is the story we're getting in the Book of Mormon too, but there's going to be a difference here. So don't blame the Book of Mormon for being bleak here. Well, what about the ancient East, the real ancient East? There's an interesting thing because you have all these inscriptions. You have a vast autobiographical literature. And Lehi's is another typical autobiography of the time. And you have the inscriptions, the heroic scriptures of the doings of kings and so forth. Well, they're idealized. The king is always victorious and glorious and this sort of thing. But everybody knew they were. They were ritualized and so forth. The Old Testament chronicles are the only ones that are different. They tell it like it was. David and Solomon are not unmitigated heroes by any means. David is not going to make it out of hell without a lot of trouble because of the things he did. And Solomon was not wise. He was a fool. I mean, he was the Shunammite made a fool of him. In his wisdom, he thought he was so wise, and having all those wives and stuff. No, he was not wise. But we find those things out in the Old Testament. But they had another side of the picture, which was very real, and they were aware of that. And that is the great wisdom literature, the great lamentation literature. This counteracted the rest. You have it in Egyptian, right from the beginning, right through, you have the lamentation literature, the lamentations of Neferohu, and their prophets too, of Amenemet, the prophecy of the lamb, the sun's eye, the destruction of mankind. There's some great works that deal with the other side of the picture and very realistic, very accurate descriptions of a world which is doomed because it's not going to get out of it. It's the Ludlow literature with the Babylonians and their epics, the Gilgamesh epic and the Adapa, Tana, are very sad. They're very bleak. See Gilgamesh's quest, can we get eternal life? And he flubs it. We cannot achieve eternal life, and it just drives him wild because he can't have eternal life. He's not going to settle for just being a drop in the ocean of being. So we have these things, and the Book of Mormon shows its authenticity at all points in it. The same gloomy, depressing routine of human folly runs through the whole thing. But then along with it, something unique. is the upbeat nature of the Book of Mormon, which you don't get in the others, you see. There's some that give it, and of course this is biblical, the Psalms, some of the Psalms of David, oh. But I once, years ago, colored all, got a cheap edition of the Book of Mormon, you get them 50 cents, you know, and colored all the upbeat verses green and all the downbeat verses red, you see. They're about equal in number. It's half up and half down. That's the way it is, you see. There's a miserable world we're living in, but the news is all good. That's the nice thing about it. And the authenticity of the one vouches for the other has given us such a true picture of this world we live in that we can trust it all the way. I turn to the Bible when I'm in distress. You get comfort from that, from sorrowing and from suffering. There are promises and passages, the Messiah, things like that with it. They've passed through many hands and many editors and been commentated many times. But here, when the Book of Mormon is like grabbing the hand of God, it's like grabbing the iron rod. You've got something very solid there. It was brought by the angel. You grabbed, you got the whole thing. It's never been explained. Here it is, it's solid, not built up of any coincidences. It's like a hand reaching down to grab you, and it says, not lost at all. The Book of Mormon is all good. So let's get to the good part as fast as we can. We need it now. Of course, having bad colds does not put one in a good temper, you know. I start looking for the bleak side of existence here. Everything. And so we have the same being who put it into the heart of Gadiant and still carried on the work of darkness from the beginning of man even down to this time. And he's the one that sows these nasty viruses. And behold, it is he who is the author of all sin. Well, that's a funny thing. And doth hand down their plots and their oaths and their covenants and their plans. Now, we've shown that before. We don't need to go into that. It's a subject that hasn't been properly treated this way. But any century of the world, of the earth's history you want to name, these bands have been there. And they have dominated. They have not just been there. Because of their secrecy, of course. Always insisting on secrecy. They actually say, we don't know about them. Ah, yes. But the mischief they perform is so great. There's so much evidence of their existence. And they keep popping out all the time. And some of them are practically indestructible. The old assassins are still going, for example. All these Abu Nidal and these outfits in the East, not just the East, but the worst used to be in China, they may still be. Well, the Triad, in Hong Kong and so forth, the terrible things go on. And then not only that, you see with the gangs in Southeast Asia, Vietnam and so forth, they not only fight each other, they start wiping out merchants or anybody else. They're not only limiting themselves to their own people, they're going everywhere now. Now they're coming, they're planting cells in towns in the Middle West, you know, where they never was in the big cities, Los Angeles, New York, that's all right. But now in the most unexpected places, they find Springville a particularly inviting place to operate. Well, it's very insidious to see that these things actually do go on like that. The police can tell you some horrifying things about that even now. But where does this concern us? Well, the more part of them with the Nephites make idols of their gold. Well, they're making too much money. Notice the 31st verse. They get so much hold upon them, we've got to finish Helaman today. Can we do it? We will. Build up idols of their gold and silver. But why did it happen so fast in the space of not so many years? Notice this astonishes the Book of Mormon historians too, as much as it does you. You say, well, how can it happen so fast? Well, they say, it is strange. Not many years it happened just like that. And again, if you look at the record, that's exactly what happened. In the 16th and 17th year of the reign, did they grow in their iniquity? The buckets in reverse rolls, the Nephites began to dwindle, the Lamanites began to grow, and thus, because of their hardness of their hearts, and we're getting behind here. Let's go to chapter 7. Already mentioned, you see, to begin with, that the Gadians had been wiped out just by preaching to them, as if that could be done. That has a lot to do on the nature of their covenants and so forth. But they have a new administration here in the 39th verse, and they obtained sole management of the government so that anything they could do was all right. And they did turn their back. The first thing they did was turn their backs upon the poor, cut all benefits and so forth, and the meek and the humble followers of God. Like the Barines, they say they're for the poor. They always do that. Like as Tolstoy says, the Barine, the Russian baron, who rules a large estate, he sees his aged peasants are suffering, so he can't bear the sight of seeing them suffering, so he sends them off to Siberia, where he won't have to see them. And that was the solution. Well, that's the same solution with us. We say we feel for the poor and so forth, but boy, do we grind them down. They were in an awful state, ripening for everlasting destruction. Now, we have the seventh chapter starts with a sad homecoming. This is a thoroughly sad story, isn't it? Because Nephi had been on a mission, the son of Helaman had been on a mission to the land of Zerum, of Zarahemla, trying to make some headway among the Nephites, and he was a complete failure. Nobody would accept him at all in the land northward. Third verse. They did reject all his words, insomuch as he could not stay among them. He had to leave. He couldn't stay. Well, at least I'm going home. Things will be better there. Forget it. They're worse when he gets home. He wished he just stood with the Zarahemla people. No, this is bad. Seeing the people in a state of such awful wickedness, and those Gadianton robbers filling the judgment seats, they know where the keys of power are. Having usurped the power and authority of the land, laying aside the commandments of God, not in the least aright before him, doing no justice unto the children of men. Here's the routine. Notice it's all personal friends and so forth. Condemning the righteous because of their righteousness. Letting the guilty and wicked go unpunished, what you might know why. Because of their money, of course. Because of their money. And moreover, to be held in office once you're in office. There's only one purpose in politics today. All of a sudden, the last 10 years or so, is to get elected. If you get elected, then that's it, you see. 85% of the incumbents in the last election were re-elected. So if you're once in, you're in. And when you're in, you can do as you're jolly well pleased. As Reston says, they're not interested in governing, they're just interested in campaigning. That's what everybody does today. And so it says here, because of their money, moreover, to be held in office at the head of government, to rule and do according to their wills. That's exactly what the racket is. Once you're in there, you're in. Nothing can get you out. Cold steel chisel won't get you out, see. So this is the bottom line here. That they might, and the thing is that they might gain in glory, the popularity. Those in office are not answerable to anyone. And the main interest, of course, is to get elected and live happy ever after. Now, here again, it goes on this next verse. And in the space of not many years, when Nephi saw it, was in agony of soul. Well, not many years again. I recall when the roaring 20s came on us overnight, and they were roaring 20s. They were excesses. The market just blew up, and they got the Great Depression, of course. But then the same thing happened in the Gilded Age in the 1870s, right after the Civil War, the Great Exploitation, the terrible things that happened. And then you get the awful strikes and social disruptions of the 80s. 1880s, but what Mark Twain called the Gilded Age, and it was gilded and everybody was living high on the hog. Colonel Beriah Sellers says, 2 years ago I didn't have a cent, and now I'm $3 million in debt. That was considered a big success, because he's doing big time, you see, that's the whole thing. And so in not many years, and when Nephi saw, just broke his heart as far as that goes, what could be going on? And then he makes, is this a naive statement he makes here? Could I have been in the days when my father Nephi first came out of Jerusalem, out of that hell? Nephi didn't have any fun at all. I could have joyed with him in the promised land. He got the promised land, he had to break off from his brethren, and he ends in a note of dire misgivings, you know. Then were the people easy to be entreated and firm to keep the command. They weren't at all, you see. He's not being, but this is a veristic touch in the Book of Mormon. We do look back to those happy times, not really knowing what they were like as far as that goes. Reading their teachings, rather. They were quick to hearken to the words of the Lord. Actually, Nephi says they're very small. The early Nephi, they're very slow to hearken to the words of the Lord. My soul would have had joy. But, now this is an interesting word he uses. Well, I can't live in those happy times. Why don't I get a better break? Why do I have to live in this land? But behold, I am consigned. These words of consignment. And there's a ninth verse there. I am consigned that these are my days, and that my soul shall be filled with sorrow because of the wickedness. I'm consigned to that. Everyone has his days assigned him. Why are we consigned? Well, everything is scheduled. And then again, we ask that question, why? Well, we got a marvelous vignette here. We'll go into that. But this idea that everything is assigned and consigned, that's part of the Book of Mormon. It's part of the doctrine we teach. How far will you accept that? You're here because you must be here. Now, because it's now. But now we have a marvelous little cultural picture in these 10th, 11th, 12th verses here. Here's a picture of a Nephite city. It's not like a European ancient city at all. It's very different. So well ordered now. Now, ancient cities, we have Aristotle's essay on the city. The city, as the ruins show us, and many still stand, I mean without being ruins, have the most tangled, narrow, tricky streets you can imagine. Well, they're supposed to. If an enemy breaks in, it's to confuse him so that he can't take the city once he's got through the walls. They're easy to defend when every native knows every bend and crook and window, but they don't, you see, you can take advantage. So, as Aristotle says, it must be designed as a maze to trick an enemy. But that's not so in the American cities at all. He describes it here. The That Geographic I mentioned the other day, it has pictures of cities here, and they're all, as you know, superbly laid out. Here's one. Come on, come on. Oh, that gives us a picture of the crooked merchants coming to the marketplace. That's a good one. But here's some of their big markets. We mentioned that before. But, here's Mexico City today. You can just see the typical. As you see, it's on the lake and built. It's all on the checkerboard style. But here's the ancient city, as the Spaniards saw it when they discovered it. It's all very neatly laid out. You see, all planned, streets wide open, all at right angles to each other, and so forth. And everything careful. And notice here are the milpas, the gardens, and the what do they call them? Oh, they have a name. I'll think of it in a second. But you see, as you go up, these are garden plots. You hear the road approaches the city, passes a garden plot here, and you get in the city, and you see there are towers here and there, and you go, everything is laid out in a very proper manner. The interesting thing is the garden surrounds, and they still do. This is the one thing that's been discovered archaeologically down at Tenochtitlan today, you see, at the big pyramid of the sun there. It was a large city, and moreover, the city was surrounded by garden patches, very systematically, and he describes it here. And behold, now it was to pass, it was upon a tower, which was in the garden of Nephi, which was by the highway which led to the chief market. We know these people are great market people. I see some of their market pictures here of their ancient markets going on. Like we never find them. Yeah, there's a picture of a market. You see, very bustling, but there's a picture of a much more impressive market here, a big city market where they're coming in. Here's a military marketplace. They get all sorts of fancy gear and that. You notice they talk about the cost of the apparel, their fine apparel. They're always emphasizing that. And they're going, well, you see why. These people overdress outrageously. Of course, these are Aztecs that come much later. But another trend of the archaeology, which is very diligent now, is the sameness, the fact that these patterns are kept for thousands of years. They don't change as much as you might think. Now here's a very impressive city. Note the towers all over the place, somebody yelling from a tower, and the boats bringing them stuff to the marketplace. The marketplaces with their awnings spread and the like, the people out with their gears, and here's an outrageously overdressed soldier. But he's making an announcement. It just comes from his mouth. And the banners are there. It's a splendid thing. It's laid out. And this is the system we have in the Book of Mormon. Nobody knew anything about that. Well, we have the Spanish record there, these pictures here. And so it just puts it in sort of incidentally. Highway which led to the chief market of the chief city, which was Zarahemla. Therefore Nephi had bowed himself upon the tower which was in his garden. As you know, these people are incurable tower people. They build towers at the drop of a hat. Which was in his garden, which tower was also near to the garden gate, by which led to the highway. So everything, the gardens, the highway going to the main marketplace. That's why you have the marketplace in the center of the city. The people passing to go to the market. It all fits the picture perfectly that we get in these old American cities. And there were men passing by and saw Nephi as he was pouring out his soul unto God upon his tower. Now Nephi was a famous man, you see. They ran and told the people. Nephi's back. The people came together in multitudes so they might know the cause of so great a mourning. This rushing together, spontaneously forming great multitudes. That's a phenomenon we're seeing in our own days that I haven't seen since the days of the French Revolution. In almost every capital of Eastern Europe, there are these spontaneous gatherings together of all the people now. First time for years that they haven't been laid on by the army for doing it. But you find it even in Prague now, which is the hardest city of them all. But in Prague, in Sofia, in Budapest, in East Berlin, even in Moscow, everybody come together spontaneously for a cause. They came together here. Well, Nephi stood up, and the people were worried. The reason they gathered, they felt something was wrong. He wouldn't be there. It tells us this later on. Nephi rose, and he beheld the multitudes. Now, in the 8th chapter, 7 to 10, it tells us why they did stir up to anger against Nephi and let this man behold his judgments. The people were... See, there's much disagreement among the people in the next chapter. Many of them feel that things are going wrong, that the Nephites are wicked, and there's something they should do about it. So when they gather here, this is Nephi has his audience. And he opened his mouth and began to speak. Doesn't rebuke them for their wickedness, of course. We are given away. How could you have given away to the enticings of him who seeks to hurl away your souls down to everlasting? Why has he forsaken you? This discontent. See, they feel that God has forsaken them. They have a case here. It is because he will not hearken to the voice of. That's why. Why has he forsaken you? God never forsakes anyone. You forsake him, he says, because you have hardened your hearts. You will not hearken. You won't listen, that's all. Instead of gathering you, he shall scatter you. Yeah. How could you have forgotten your God in the very day that he delivered you? But behold, here's the good old answer again, routine, verse 21. Behold, it is to get gain, to be praised of men, yea, that you might get gold and silver, that you might set your hearts upon riches and the vain things of the world, for the which you do murder and plunder and steal and bear false witness. This is what people do to get money. I wouldn't believe it. For if ye will not repent, those great cities round about, the land of our possession, shall be taken away. And this is how God's going to punish them. And you have no strength at all. You just have to stand by yourself against your enemies. It shall be better for the Lamanites than for you. They are more righteous than you, he says in the 24th verse. They have not sinned against great knowledge. You have greater knowledge. Their sins may be just as bad, but much less, their knowledge isn't as great. So that's a redeeming factor. He will lengthen out their days and increase their seed when thou shalt be utterly destroyed. This is what happened, of course, except thou repent. Ye have united yourself to that secret band. Crooks own the country. That pride has lifted you up, which is good because of your exceeding riches. The pride which ye have suffered to enter into your hearts, that has lifted you up beyond that which is good because of your exceeding riches, the cause of it all. Even your land shall be taken from you, and you shall be destroyed from off the face of the earth. Well, this is the standard call of the prophets of old. This is what Solomon preached to the Athenians, just the same words, might be exactly word for word. He's so much like Lehi, and who was it? I was thinking about Solomon is so much like. Well, anyway, that's right. It's a medieval chronicle. Well, now there were judges of the band in the crowd, of course, judges of the secret band, and they were angry. These dignified judges, they've been getting away with it for years, and they didn't like this at all. Everyone's getting payola, you see, as it tells us in the 38th chapter, the 6th verse. The judges were in on it like everybody else, and here they are. They were in the band. There's so many of them. Why don't you grab the guy? They said, why don't you seize upon this man? He's reviling against this people, against our law. He's reviling against our law. That means he's reviling against the people. They're going to make a case against him, but they're really worried about it. He might expose us. Righteous indignation, you know, concerning, who was talking about them, concerning the corruptness of their law. Those judges were angry because he spake plainly concerning their secret works of darkness. That's what they were afraid of. Give away the whole thing. Shut up. You'll give away everything, they say. Their defense is a counterattack, of course, the best defense. So they cried unto the people, saying, why do you suffer this man to revile us? Behold, he doth condemn all this people. It's you he's a-blaming. It's the American people he's accusing, etc., etc. We use this American people to death, don't we? As if they were a pool of wisdom or something. Well, there may be something there, but they're just like other people. Cry unto the people, saying, yes, he doth condemn all this people, and also that these our great cities shall be taken from us. It's impossible. We're powerful. Our cities are great. They can't possibly break in on us. Now, thus they did stir up the people to anger against Nephi, raising contentions among them, and showing that there was a lot of trouble already. People were worried because some people pitched in and said, now, wait a minute, he's right, after all. Let him alone, he's a good man. All the judgments will come upon us. He has testified aright unto us concerning our iniquities. It was no secret then. Excuse me. Is it today a secret? Yea, behold, if he had not been a prophet, he couldn't have testified these things. He's been out of town, you see. Nephi, they were compelled because of the fear that the others could not attack Nephi. That saved him. They did not lay their hands upon him, therefore he began to speak. Now, therefore he was constrained to speak unto them more, saying, behold, my brethren, have you not read that God gave power unto Moses, one man, even Moses? They have the scriptures, you see, and they're being bound by the scriptures. And so much that the Israelites, who our fathers came through on dry ground, he uses the standard arguments, of course, especially the Red Sea. They always refer to the Red Sea, the Jews, and that is the power. The Red Sea, the delivering Israel through the Red Sea, is the standard argument of God's demonstration of power on earth, because it was a historical event, and they all had record of that. This man, Moses, could bear record that the Son of God should come, look upon the serpent, look upon the Son of God. All the body of all the holy prophets from his day even to Abraham. He goes backward, you see, Moses down to Abraham, and then from Abraham backward too. Down to Abraham saw of his coming. And but there were many before the days of Abraham who were called by the order of God, even after the order of his son. Notice he's referring, we've called them the brotherhood, it isn't right, I suppose, the priesthood, the order, before Abraham's day, but you belong to the one order or the other. Remember, you've just been told in explicit terms that Satan had organized and created these things and worked with them from the beginning. It's his doing. He, the same being, the work of darkness from the beginning, and he swore all men into this, the great abominations of darkness, and he gave them, he handed down their plots and their oaths and their covenants and their plans. And on the other hand, you had this other arrangement, you see, the before the days of Abraham, they were called by Abraham. They were called after the order of God, even after the order of the Son. And this, that it should be shown unto the people a great many thousands of years before his coming. A great many thousands, that's an estimated expression. A great many thousands. A thousand is a lot, a great many, you see. You say a great many thousands, doesn't have to be thousands of thousands. 2,000 is a great many thousand. A great many years, 1,000. Abraham. Zenos did testify boldly. Because now he's naming the prophets down from Abraham, you see. Zenos and Zenoch and Esaias, Abraham in the middle. Oh, why not the Son of God come according to his prophecy? Now will you dispute that Jerusalem was destroyed? You have the seed of Zedekiah, you have the Munachites with us to tell us that it was. Our father Lehi was driven out of Jerusalem because he testified of these things. Was the reason. He is God and he is with them. Ye have rejected all these things, notwithstanding so many evidences. What evidences? Then he gives the standard evidence to the philosophers here, right next, you see, this 24th verse. Both the things in heaven and all things. Nephi chooses the argument of the whole picture. When you look at the whole picture, the question is, how does it happen then in a world that is nothing but threatening, when unspeakable powers are loose and all beyond control and so forth, everything happened just by chance and jumble and so forth and so on, that everything is to be possible for us to live such a comfortable life? However hard it is, we could be, if we behaved ourselves, even more comfortable. But how is it that with the solar wind on one side, with the ether on the other, the various ultraviolet and so forth on the other side, that we're able to live, that we're able to survive at all? Well, there are the 15 constants that have to be adjusted. Something has made this world comfortable for us. See the argument he uses. If the earth was just a little farther from the sun, we couldn't be living on it. If it was a little closer to the sun, we couldn't be living on it. If it revolved a little faster, we couldn't be living on it. If it revolved a little slower, if it was a little drier, life would be impossible for us. If it was a little wetter, life would be impossible for us. If it was a little hotter, we couldn't live on it. If it was a little colder, everything is fine-tuned, you see, is fine-tuned. There are these constants, these 15 fine-tuned constants, as physicists call them, that have to be adjusted to each other, absolute perfection, with a chance of it happening accidentally, a trillion to nothing, something like that, you see, absolutely fabulous. Well, that's the one he's talking about. He uses the argument of the big picture, the whole picture, things both in heaven and all things which are in the earth, as a witness that they are true. We call that today the anthropic principle, the fact that man not only fits into the thing, but he's the only one who comprehends it. It wouldn't be. It's not for any other person's benefit. Without him, nothing's aware of it. It doesn't even exist. It's not there. Who cares, you see, when something happens? It is arranged for us, with us in mind. So we're the only ones that can comprehend it. We're the only ones that can enjoy it. And yet, with all these things beyond our control utterly, here we are fitting into the picture so very nicely. There's something wrong there. And this is the argument he's using here. And you can discount the treasures. Don't discount, he says, lay up for yourself treasures in heaven where nothing doth corrupt, where nothing can come which is unclean. You're heaping up for yourselves wrath against the... This is the large view, you see. This is, and then, even at this time, ye are ripening. because of your murders and your fornications. The band has its grip on everything now. Yea, behold, it is now even you at your doors. You go to your judgment seat. Now, this is what the corruption is doing. Go to your judgment seat, search, and behold, your judge is murdered, and he lieth in his blood, and he hath murdered, been murdered by his brother who seeketh to sit in the judgment seat. A routine. The only thing here that has to, that takes inspiration is timing. You can always be sure it would happen, because after all, when, how many percent? I suppose it was about 80% of the Roman emperors were bumped off by their successors. You could always count on it happening. The only question is when, you see. Well, he was inspired to say it had already happened. Otherwise, it would have been a perfectly safe guess. He could have said, sooner or later, you can go to the judgment seat and your judge is murdered, and lying in his blood, murdered by his brother. Because if you know a judge has a brother, if you know what the judge is after, and what kind of people those are, you know what's going to happen. Behold, I mentioned that Gregor of Tours, the 10 books of Frankish history written in the 5th and 6th century. Again, like the Nephites and Lamanites, it's between the Burgundians and the Franks. But that story of Fredegunda and Brunhilde, the woman, the queen, what they did for power and so on, is as horrendous as anything you can imagine in the Book of Mormon. The things they do to each other, the plots. It's inevitable that when somebody gets king, everybody's going to try to bump him off and see. And the tricks, well, the king plays of Shakespeare, of which you wrote many, they're nothing but that. They move in high-flown language, marvelous, for a muse of fire that would ascend the very heaven of invention, princes to act and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Well, it's a great show to see. It's not nothing, if you did, but murder and intrigue. So here we go. It's even now at your doors, and so the men ran to the judgment seat, and sure enough, behold, the chief judge had fallen in his blood and did lie in the earth. And of course they were afraid, and they did quake and fall into the earth. Now this falling to the earth is a thing to notice in the Book of Mormon. Every time you're afraid, you fall flat on your face. Do you do that when you're, does fear have that effect on you? I've remained standing when I've been scared stiff. How come these people all fall down when they're afraid? Well, this is routine. They have to do this particular thing. This is a very interesting arrangement, what we have here. What the Egyptians call senta. Senta, your nose on the ground, you see. Whenever you see that anything shocks you, remember, you live in a religious world. You live in a state of a sacral state. And it's true, we're surrounded by, I mentioned these powers, these marvelous things around us all the time, they're real. So if something unexpected absolutely bowls you over, you can't possibly expect what happens. You're in the presence of some great or divine influence, you don't know whether it's good or bad. But you know it's powerful, it's more powerful than you are, so what do? You play safe, you take the position of complete submission, you fall on your face, and it becomes quite automatic. Women, children, everybody do it. You fall, because in the presence of someone who can smite you or anything else, that's a defensive position, is what you're doing here. You go flat on your face and you stay there, and it's until it's safe for you to move. Until everything is in order. Now, I read from that a very ancient rite in the founding of the Kingdom of Egypt in the terrible times, Papyrus 8, Salt 825a. It begins, the terrible, all the powers of nature were unleashed in such a degree that even the gods were frightened. And it says all the gods covered their heads with their hands and then fell down and put their heads between their knees and held that position because they were terrified to decide what would happen. Those were gods doing this, you see. So this is a natural thing. We may all do it someday. Well, what's the natural thing to do in our society? If you hear a shooting, what happens? Everyone goes flat on the ground. That's the safest position to have. I suppose today in Salvador, everybody spends most of the day flat on his face. Yes, well, what other position can you have that's safe? And so here he says, they fell right flat, and there they were, flat, and did quake, and fallen to the earth. Now immediately, immediately when the judge had been murdered, he had been stabbed by his brother by a garb of secrecy, and he fled, and the servants ran and told the people and raised a cry of murder among them. And people went there and found these five men still in their positions of submission, still lying there. It tells us here in in verse 14, right across the page, it tells us, we ran, they're telling their story, they say, we ran and came to the place of judgment, and when we saw all things even as Nephi had testified, we were astonished insomuch that we fell to the earth. And when we recovered our astonishment before, they cast us into prison. So they got over their astonishment. They weren't that way all the time. They find, it says there, they didn't find them lying flat on their face. It said they found the five men. They saw those five men who had fallen up to earth. The seventh minute tells us when they recovered from their astonishment, then they were cast into prison. Well, these are the men who have murdered the judge, because look, here they are and here he is. So they cast him into prison, and on the morrow they assembled together at fast and the burial of the great chief, the great state occasion. And thus all those judges at the garden of Nephi, they gathered together. A very dramatic situation, which you get in a typical Greek tragic scene. Remember, we're talking about city-states here, but a tragedy is a practical thing. The people all do meet together. And remember, the kingdoms of Europe today, the republics and so forth of Europe, the people do meet together in the public square in the main capital, and they do that from time to time. They're doing it today spontaneously. Some of these, like this one in Prague, said they had no leaders. They couldn't find any leaders. People just came together spontaneously. Tiananmen Square, wherever you go. And so the same thing. They came for this big thing to happen, fast and burial of a great chief, and the judges who were at the Garden of Nephi, I'd be sure they were there, and they were gathered at the burial, and it came to pass the people said, well, who are the five men? And the judges declared that they should be brought. Aha. Yeah. She told me to move it. It's not getting my coughing louder. Clear enough, eh? They told him all that they had done, saying, and we were astonished, and we fell to earth. Well, of course, the judges had an explanation for that. Quick on that. The judges did expound the matter to the people, did say to them, well, behold, now we see this Nephi agreed with them. They've been set up by Nephi to tell this story, he says. It's a typical public relations trick on the part of the judge, that they might convert us unto his faith. It was a trick he had. He was going to perform a fake miracle, see, and that would convert us. See, everybody's overplaying everybody else. It's like the two Japanese merchants that's met in a railroad station in Tokyo, and the one says, where are you going? He says, I'm going to Osaka. And he looks at him and lies, says, you're lying, you know. You are going to Osaka. So everybody's trying to overreach everybody else here. And the same thing here. Then he might declare it unto us that he might have converted us to his faith, that he might raise himself to be a great man according to the chosen. It was all a plan, all a public relations trick by Nephi. Wouldn't you know that? That standing on his tower and all that sort of thing. And now behold, we detect this man, and we shall confess his fault and make known unto us the true murderer. The five were liberated. They did rebuke the judges, and they did contend with them one by one, but they confounded the judges, the five. Nevertheless, the fact that they had to be cleared, that didn't make any difference. You can't fight City Hall. They were all thrown into jail anyway, and they were sentenced to be executed. Nevertheless, caused that Nephi should be taken, and they accused them of death. Accused to death. They passed death sentence on them. And Nephi said, you poor fools, uncircumcised of heart, you ought to begin to howl and mourn because of the great destruction which at this time doth await you, except ye shall repent. And behold, as I have said, with a man we should murder, that he should murder Zizram, our chief judge. The judge's name was Zizram. And we had a Zizram before. You see what that is? That Zizr, the Egyptian word Zizr, a very popular name. Zizr, remember, founded the third dynasty of Egypt. The name means holy, sacred. Our word Deseret comes from that. It's usually written that. So because the land of Egypt, the holy land, the red land, is called Deseret, the holy land. And of course, the symbol of the lowland is the bee. But this is the Deseret name, the Zizram name. It pops up throughout the Book of Mormon. Well, I'll show you another sign. He says, go to the house of Siantum, and who is the brother of Zizram, and say to him, and tells him what to say. So they do, and he said, well, what you say to him, have you murdered your brother? Has Nephi, the pretended prophet, who doth prophesy so much evil concerning this people, agree with thee, in which ye have murdered Zizram, who is your brother? Behold, he shall say, no, nothing. And he shall say unto him, have you murdered your brother? Then he'll be you'll take him, he'll be taken aback and know not what to say. And of course he'll deny it, and he shall make as if he were astonished of all things. And behold, you shall examine him, you'll find blood on the skirts of his cloak, and then shall greater fear come upon him, and then he will confess. That's his, but he doesn't fall down, you know. And then shall you know that I am an honest man. Well, they did the same thing, and he did deny, and also according to the words he did confess. And now there were, by this time, there were some people who said that Nephi was a prophet. Moreover, that he was a god. See, they would have called him, ancient, they would have called him a sophist, sophus, a wise traveling man who, to whom a divine power was attributed in the ancient world. So, of course, there arose a division, chapter 10. There arose a division among the people, and they were divided, leaving Nephi alone. This is a dramatic situation where they go in both ways, part both ways, remember, and leave one hero standing alone. Where does that happen? In Julius Caesar. Remember, after Antony's speech, the people go one way, the senators go another way, and leave Antony standing all alone with the bear there in the center of the forum. And he says, mischief thou art afoot, now let it work. You see, it's very dramatic. They go in both ways and leave him standing alone there. The same thing here we see. I say this is quite a picturesque situation. Leaving Nephi alone as he was standing in the midst of them, he moves off sorrowfully going home. Well, there you are, and didn't get anywhere with them. Nephi went his way toward his own house, but on the way, it's time something happens now. And of course, now you get the intervention of an angel. Angels don't just come because people want them or any old time, but always at a crucial time when nothing else can break the jam. As he was pondering in his heart, behold, a voice came unto him, saying, blessed art thou, Nephi, for those things which thou hast done. Thou hast not feared, thou hast sought thine own life. I will bless thee forever. I will make thee mighty in word and deed and faith. Even all things shall be done unto thee according to thy word. Now, this is a very interesting condition. You will have to, anything you say will be done, because anything you say will be exactly what I want you to say. So that's safe, you see, as far as that goes. He says here, all things shall be done unto thee according to thy word, for thou shalt not ask that which is not according to, contrary to my will. So if you ask anything contrary, it might happen, but I know I can trust you, you'll ask what I want you to ask, so that's all right. Moses 1:25, the same thing happens again. He says, I'll make you as strong as many waters here. Your voice shall be as mine. You shall lead my people, because I know whatever you say is what I want you to say. So verse 6, we have that kind of man. There's a single will here. Does Nephi have a free will? That's for philosophers to argue about. Behold, thou art Nephi, and I am God. Behold, I declare it unto thee in the presence of mine angels. Ye shall have power over this people to smite the earth with famine. It gives him a broad hint, you see, a suggestion. You will have power to smite the earth with famine and with pestilence and destruction according to the wickedness of the people. So he planted the idea, obviously, in the Nephi, with Nephi, behold, I give unto you power that whatsoever you shall seal on earth shall be sealed in heaven, and whatsoever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven, and thus shall ye have power over the people. Now this goes beyond ordinances, you see. We talk about ordinances, Peter 13 and 18, you see. 3:18 in Peter. 1 Peter, whatsoever you bind on earth you shall seal in the scripture. Well, this goes beyond that, you see. This is more than an ordinance. There is an understanding between the worlds, we're told, which is expressed by the priesthood, and is expressed nowhere else. So there is this understanding and coordination between the worlds, and that's what we have here. So you will have power, whatsoever you have seen in this world, will go over in heaven and the other way around. And thus, if you shall say unto the temple, it shall be rent. Notice the temple is the connecting point between the world. It is the Marcus Mayor Arats. It is the point at which heaven and earth meet. And if you want to break it, you want the temple, it doesn't say the veil of the temple, that it shall be rent in twain, it shall be done. And if you shall say unto this mountain, be thou cast down, and become smooth, it shall be done. See, God trusts Nephi all the way, not to do foolish things. He knows darn well Nephi's not going to go around casting mountains down just to show his power. He knows by now that he can trust Nephi to do only what he would do himself. So you can trust Nephi here. But he's operating here. So here is the power of the other world being projected down here as with a beam, the focusing of mighty powers upon this little earth, as a famous German physicist says, is simply staggering what it takes to make life on this earth possible from the most distant points of outer space, the elements and the energy is being focused right here from operating there. This is the sort of thing we're talking about, I suppose. And if you shall say that God shall smite this people, it shall come to pass. Now, I see the time is up. I command you, and ye shall go and declare unto this people, except ye repent, ye shall be smitten to destruction. And the Lord has spoken these words to Nephi. He did not go into his own house, didn't even go home to change his clothes, but he returned to the multitudes who are gathered, multitudes, plural, you notice, multitudes who are gathered around, who are gathered about upon the face of the land. And characteristic of this, as of other cultures, is the heliocentric point, the great temple, the great shrine, the great mound, the great tower, which is the center of the land and which marks the place at which people assemble, wherever there's any alarm or emergency, or whether any great message to be given, and there they were, and they're ready to listen to Nephi here.